Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Apparently in Japan, it's called Grandpa Carl's Flying House. Yeah, I like that better than Up.
Welcome to Recotopia, a happy home for recommended movies, shows, and music from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Jeremy Scott.
Shit, I'm like 5 minutes from being so far gone, you're not even going to be able to imagine the places I'm going, okay?
You're going nowhere, because you got nothing.
You know what I got. You just can't deal with the fact that I beat you.
Oh, yeah? What have you got? Huh? What have you got?
You know what I've got.
Hello, everybody.
Hello.
It is Ragatopia episode 38. Yes, that's right. I am Chris Atkinson.
And I am Jeremy Scott.
And today's movie, today's big recommend is The Score
of
2001. We are once again speaking live to a studio audience in Burbank, California. people on Twitch and YouTube, and thank you again once again for coming out and chatting while we sit here and discuss silly things like movies and dinners and you know, just basic life things, man. Anyway, hey, do you have any small recommends, Jeremy?
It's no big deal.
Itty-bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
I got the small. I'm going to go with the movie I had seen before, maybe 5-6 years ago, and liked. And then it came on again this week, and I watched it. It's called Begin Again.
Ooh, I've never
seen this. It's a 2013 movie directed by John Carney, who made Sing Street, which is a movie that you have recommended to me that I have not seen yet. Begin Again stars Keira Knightley and Mark Ruffalo. Haley Steinfeld's in it as well, but not to a super great extent. She plays Ruffalo's daughter, and they're kind of estranged. And this movie, like Sing Street, is about music. He basically gets fired from his record exec job he co-founded with Mos Def. Mos Def fires him and lets him go, and he goes to dive bars drinking, and one night on an open mic hears Keira Knightley's character sing. There's this really cool scene where he turns once he goes from realizing, oh, that might be a good song, and actually paying attention to her, he envisions all the instruments on the stage around her that aren't being used coming to life and playing with her. And you can hear what he would produce the song as in a studio, and where the instruments would come in, and what riffs they would play. And she's just strumming a guitar and singing, but the song ends up being this fully produced thing. And then at the very end, it all cuts out, and it's just her doing the last line again. It's a really cool scene. And so he takes her to the record label, but Mos Def is like, I don't see the potential. And then he convinces her to make their own album without a studio, and they just shoot live in New York, outside, with the sounds of New York and some of the famous locations being an undertrack to all the songs they record. And from there, I will leave you to it. It's charming. The music's pretty good for a song, or for a movie about songwriting. They have good chemistry. They don't couple up together. They have good chemistry as a producer and songwriter. And this is on Showtime. And it's on Hulu with a premium subscription because of the Showtime thing. If you have Showtime or you want to rent that, I think you would enjoy it. It's called Begin Again. There you go. So that's my first small recommend.
Yeah, yeah. I remember when this came out, it had really good reviews, and I want to see this. I definitely want to see this movie. I forgot that it existed, and I am glad that you brought this up. So I will eventually watch that. I got around to watching on HBO the Nathan Fielder series, The Rehearsal.
Oh, my.
And I'll tell you straight up right off the bat that this is this is usually not my bag. I don't typically like when somebody this isn't a prank show, but it has vibes of a prank show, right? Because there's people who are sort of not in on what's going on completely, and they're taking all of this as real life, I get uncomfortable with people being in a show where someone else is doing a thing and it's reality and they have no clue. You know, that's why I never got into like those old prank shows like Punked and stuff like that. It's like everybody's like, ha ha, look at what an idiot that celebrity is for doing this stuff. And it's like everybody would do that stuff if this type of stuff happened. It's not really fun at all for me. But this is a different kind of thing, even though it's still uncomfortable. I'm going to tell you right off, Jeremy, you may not like this, but there's enough of an art to this that I believe that you might find this fascinating.
Okay. All right.
Now, Nathan made a show called Nathan for You on Comedy Central, where he would take people's businesses and he would come up with an idea for that business that probably was going to be a colossal failure, and it was all for the jokes. And I think one of the first episodes was he found an ice cream parlor and he said, let's make a poo flavor for your business or whatever. And you know, obviously you're not taking actual poo, but you're getting a lab to come up with a poo flavor for an ice cream. And so that was the thing. It was like, see what happens if you put this poo flavor in there, and you know, stuff like that for your businesses. Now, apparently, before each one of these episodes, Nathan Fielder felt like he and his crew needed to rehearse all the possible outcomes of what could happen when they asked these businesses to do these type of things. So from that idea, from that situation, he made this show, which is about rehearsing for real life situations. And the very first episode of The Rehearsal is about a guy who has been going to this trivia night, and we're very familiar with trivia nights. We used to go to trivia night all the time. He goes to trivia night with this mixed company of people, and he told them a long time ago that he has two master's degrees and something like that. And it was a complete lie. And he's been living that lie all of his life, even though probably nobody cares about his two master's degrees in this group or whatever. But it has been weighing on him, and he wants to finally come out with the truth. So Nathan Fielder gets an exact replica of this guy to rehearse stuff on him that he's going to go and do with the real guy.
Oh my goodness.
And the real guy has to rehearse with friends who look just like the friends and act like the friends that he deals with at the trivia night. And they throw all the scenarios at him just so that he can get prepared for the big night and finally let the big secret out. And so the whole first episode is about this. And by the end of it, it has a somewhat surprising turn to it. And then in the second episode, he's finding this, there's a woman who wants to know what raising a child is like before she actually has a child. She's not even in a relationship or anything, but she just wants to know raising a child is like. So there's a whole rehearsal with like her at a house with this baby that they keep changing out with different ages all throughout the entire process. And there's all sorts of just like, she starts dating this guy that might possibly be a potential father, and she has to tell him, hey, I'm on this show, and this is what's happening here. If you're okay with that, you can do this, and blah, blah. And so, like, and there's so many just different levels to this rehearsal thing. Have you ever seen Synecdoche, New York?
No. I mean, I've been to the city, but not the movie.
Well, you went through Schenectady or whatever. Yes. This one's Synecdoche, which is actually a word that means, I can't, the definition is one of those weird things, like anyway, the movie is a Charlie Kaufman movie starring Philip Seymour Hoffman, where he wants to do this play, and the play basically just takes on a life of its own, and it's like there's a rehearsal every day, but it's like he keeps adding things to it for realism, and it becomes where the play is actually these people's lives and things like that. And it reminded me of that. But anyway, the rehearsal is just, it's such an interesting concept. I don't think you've seen anything truly like it except for the one movie that I've been able to bring up.
Right.
And it's just, I think you'll know whether you want to see this or not after the first episode. But like the whole thing with the kids, and they keep passing around, they keep changing out the kids and all this stuff. It gets crazy, man.
It sounds crazy.
This is like the distance between reality and fiction is so crazy. So anyway.
All right. That's intriguing. I will at least check out an episode to see. Mm-hmm. Because you're right. It does sound like it might fascinating, well, not necessarily hitting my entertainment sweet spot.
Nathan Fielder, who is in on it, looks like he's going through some learning things as well on this. Now, I don't know, a lot of that's one of the things about the show that is endlessly debated as to how much of his involvement is, you know, real. Like, you know, or is he like just, you know, is everything just for the bit? You know, is this all for the bit? But
yeah.
Anyway, it's a fascinating show.
All right. All right. Well, my second small recommend for this week, I'm going back to 1988, a movie I haven't seen since probably 1992. A movie called Colors, starring Robert Duvall and Sean Penn.
I haven't seen this in forever.
I hadn't either. And it's directed by Dennis Hopper. This movie also has Don Cheadle in it, Damon Wayans, Mario Lopez, really young Mario Lopez. Mm-hmm. This movie is pretty good. It holds up pretty well. Like, I remember renting it in college and liking it, and that was about it. I was willing to watch anything a good actor like Duvall or Sean Penn would do. And I hadn't heard of it at the time when I found it at the video store, but this is about gang violence, the Crips and the Bloods in Los Angeles. Now, this is made in 1988. So you need to understand that some 1980s-ness exists in this movie. Plenty. Like a lot of the gang members look more like music video gang members than real gang members. A lot of the dialogue is heavily 80s. There's a lot of homie being thrown around, which I know is a real word that gets used, but it's kind of excessively used in this movie. But basically, Duvall is this older cop, and his new partner is Sean Penn, and he's just a hothead. He wants to bust heads and stop crime at all costs. And Duvall, he's been doing this for years. He's got a relationship with people all throughout the community on his beat. People who were gang members who have then grown up to be adults know him on a first name basis as he drives through. And so his approach to all of their stops is to de-escalate. And there's even one kid they stop with like a tiny little bit of marijuana or something. And Duvall lets him go, and Sean Penn gets angry. He's like, we're supposed to stop crime. And he's like, when you've been on the street as long as I have, you understand what crime is and what, you know, crime is not. And our job is to steer these kids any way we can. away from the gangs, even if that's to go smoke a joint. They butt heads and clash. He tries to date Maria Conchita Alonso.
Yep.
But she also does not really enjoy his mad as hell persona. He gets a reputation in the community as Pac-Man, which is negative because he wrecks one car, and then they have to drive around in this bright yellow car. But people know him from miles away and don't want anything to do with him. And then there's a climax and stuff happens, yada, yada, yada. By the end of the movie, we've jumped ahead, and Sean Penn is the older, wiser cop who wants to play the long game. And he's got a hothead, brash young partner who just wants to bust heads. And we've come full circle. And I didn't spoil anything in that. I think you would still enjoy the ride. That is on HBO Max if you want to check it out. Colors, 1988. That's my second recommend.
Man, this late 80s Sean Penn is just unhinged, man. He is in a lot of really intense roles. I don't know if it's because he just gravitated towards it or if this is what all he was getting, but remember around this time he's getting like Casualties of War, which is really, really intense in that. And the pre Will Smith, Martin Lawrence Bad Boys that he's in that time too. I mean, God, he's in so many of these like really intense things, and he's super Sean Penny in this one.
Oh yeah.
He's going on a run during this late 80s period. All right. Complete left turn, as I go, to a completely movie-less, recommend, episode. I'm going to recommend for you sports fans out there, and I guess technically you American sports fans or people who overseas who love your American sports, the YouTube channel Secret Base. I'm not even sure if that picture is the right thing, but maybe it is, and I'm sorry, Aaron, if I'm saying that out of turn there. But Secret Base, the YouTube icon is a like a home plate, they have a whole bunch of series on sports figures and plays that you know, like famous plays from baseball and football, that they tell a whole story about how we got to this point. And they tell you this really entertaining story about all these famous things. But the one thing that made me want to recommend Secret Base is they did a 4-part series on a pitcher that I knew of in the 80s, but I did not care one bit about. He played for the Toronto Blue Jays. His name's Dave Steed. And when you grow up as a kid in the 80s and the way baseball was talked about back in those days, Dave Steed wouldn't have hit your radar because he didn't win a lot of games. And as we know, pitching wins really depend on whether your team scores runs for you. And I think a lot of times people, they would equate like number of wins as to a great pitcher. And then, but they did a whole, there's 4 parts. I mean, it's maybe 2.5 hours worth of Dave Steve. And you're like, no way could this be entertaining, but they talk about how this guy came from nowhere. Basically he wasn't groomed to be a pitcher at all. And they just said, hey, why don't you start pitching? This is when the Toronto Blue Jays were just expanding into the league, 1977. They said, why don't you try pitching? So he tried pitching and he was good at it. And he got called to the majors pretty quickly. And he was really good at it, like almost immediately. And they go through all this stuff that he's going through where he's basically getting a lot of disrespect because baseball writers back in the day really cared about pitching wins. They really cared about it a lot. And they show like how many times Dave Steeb was robbed of the Cy Young Award, probably at least 3 times, if not 4, in the early 80s. And it also goes through a number of no hitters that he nearly threw that got into the ninth inning. And for one reason or another, they go through all the different ones and what happened to each of those no hitters. And I was excited because I had no idea. There's the secret base. They go through each no hitter, and they go through all the different contract negotiations and all this stuff. I couldn't tear my eyes off of this Dave Steeb thing. It's a great, I think you would love the Dave Steeb thing, but they have a whole bunch of other things. They go through football plays. They go through obscure football rules. They go through all sorts of different things like that. Tell a good story. But the way the Dave Steeb one starts off is they start off with Roy Halladay when he was 21, and he's pitching a no hitter, and he's pitching a no hitter against the Tigers, and Bobby Higginson hits this ball to left field. It goes out, and Roy Halladay loses his no hitter, and he loses a shutout after 8 2/3 innings. Jeez. Who catches that ball but Dave Steeb out in the bullpen? And they said it's really interesting that he's the one who catches this ball, because he's the one who knows more about throwing no hitters than anybody in the world, basically. And then they talked about the calculations, the absurd odds it would take for Dave Steeb to have been in the bullpen and to be in this area to catch that ball at that time, especially since Dave Steeb had retired in 1993, I believe, and was just making a comeback for this 1 year. So a lot of different things that go into that. The way they tell these stories is fascinating. I think Secret Base deserves a look from you sports fans, and I don't think you'll be disappointed in it. So
there you go. I like me some baseball these days. I would like to check this out. I bet statistically, and I'm sure this is part of what the channel does, but I bet statistically there's a lot of examples of people who never got the respect they're due. Like, if we take the modern statistics that are much more accurate and apply them back, we'll find more than just Dave Steeb, probably.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt about it.
All right. Well, I think it's time for the big recommend.
Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health, or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
2001's The Score.
Mm-hmm.
A movie that Ed Norton claimed he decided to do simply so that he would have his name on a poster with Robert De Niro and Marlon Brando. This was originally offered to Ben Affleck and Michael Douglas. Score is a movie about a heist of a scepter from the Montreal consulate building. And Ed Norton is the inside man. Marlon Brando is essentially, I don't know what you would call him in he's the fence, I guess. He sort of finds the jobs and then sells the stolen shit.
He's sort of a guy who hears things and he's like the producer, basically, where it's like
the heist.
Where it's like, hey, I know of a thing, let's get these people together so that they can do the thing. So basically,
the movie opens with De Niro doing a heist. It's a pretty cool scene. I think there's very little dialogue, not only after the heist is done, but we see almost his whole bits of travel all the way back to his home. He lives in Montreal. He owns a jazz club. He has a romance with Angela Bassett whenever they're both in town, which is not often. He owns a nice home. He owns a shitty dump of a home that's his workshop, where he figures out how to crack safes and stuff. And Brando pitches him on this heist of a scepter, says he has an inside man at the place where it's being held, and De Niro turns him down, doesn't want to do it, doesn't work in his own town, lives in Montreal, doesn't want to piss in his own pool, as somebody says later in the film. So Ed Norton's character Jack gets the bright idea to just follow him and then pretend to bump into him on the street in character as Brian. Brian is this never determined what it is guy with mental disabilities that has endeared himself to the workers of this facility, specifically the head janitor, and comes every night at midnight and helps the head janitor clean. And when that guy is looking the other way, he's casing the joint, making maps, stealing blueprints, copying keys, getting ready to steal this scepter that has come in a piano, an ancient piano, inside the leg. But wouldn't you know it, it had termites. And so they had to burn that piano, and he barely in character managed to point out and save the scepter.
I have a lot of questions about this.
Okay.
By the way.
Okay.
I understand that there's termites in the piano and they had to quarantine it off and they put a lot of plastic around it and all that. But the museum or whatever, the conservatory or whatever the hell it is.
Yeah.
Knows there's a scepter in there, right? Or do they not know? How does he know?
He had somebody on, I think it was Max Brando's character, had somebody on the other end put it in the piano. All this guy had to do was retrieve it.
I got it. See, that was the detail I missed. I was like sitting there going, like, if the museum is getting the scepter or whatever, why would they burn the piano down before they got it? Anyway, right. I missed that detail completely.
So they save the scepter. He rescues it, but they put it in a safe downstairs in a much more restricted area. And now the heist is going to be more complicated, especially because he's bumping into De Niro on the street, which is unprofessional. And De Niro gets mad. And De Niro goes to Max to complain. Ed Norton follows him there and starts an argument. And it really gets off on a few wrong feet here. But ultimately, De Niro is convinced to take the job when Max offers him $6 million of the take, which would be enough for De Niro to buy his jazz club outright and get out of the business, which is what he wants to do. And then the heist movie portion of this movie begins, and they have to steal some computer codes, but the hacker gets caught. So then they have to go to a park and have what I think is a very entertaining exchange with the guy who knows the codes. They have to case the consulate to figure out how De Niro is going to get in. And of course, Ed Norton's job will be to turn off the cameras and the sensors at the right time as De Niro is moving through the cages to steal the scepter. We do have a fun little double cross at the end. We can talk more about the movie before we get into that. But having said all that and laid it all out, you never saw this movie, I believe, before this episode.
Never
so what have. Were your impressions of the score?
It's an interesting sort of throwback kind of movie. I mean, this came out in 2001, but like it, I don't know. It took me back to that era of movies. 2001 is very 2001-ish in the way it presents itself. It's kind of interesting. De Niro was hired on. Well, you know, De Niro was desired to be on this film because of Heat and Ronin and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I find it interesting that they were going to do Ben Affleck and Michael Douglas, and they ended up getting legendary actors, Marlon Brando, Robert De Niro, and then future sort of legend Edward Norton in all of this. I don't think this movie isn't really demanding of these actors. That's the weird thing watching it is like, it's like, wow, that's Marlon Brando. And wow, that's Robert De Niro. But it's not like anybody could play these assholes.
Oh yeah.
De Niro, De Niro puts in a lot of his seasoned vet, you know, experience into this. So I think it probably does need somebody kind of like De Niro, who's like super professional and is meticulous about everything in this. But everybody's really good. Brando's weird. And of course he is in a weird period of time for Brando. Like Brando is far from his peak, right? He's This is
the last completed film before mm-hmm. he died. And yes, I glanced at some trivia about this movie, and he was walking around the set naked. He kept calling Frank Oz Miss Piggy or Fozzie to the point where De Niro had to direct Brando with an earpiece in so Frank Oz could tell him what to do.
Oh, my God.
He was
a nightmare.
Endlessly pranking De Niro with a remote-controlled electronic whoopee cushion. It's just, he's in a very it reminded me of the stories about Island of Dr. Moreau, where he wanted mm-hmm. to take off his hat and have a dolphin fin there. And he refused to smile for the last line of the film, just wouldn't do it. So they digitally altered his mouth to make it look like he smiles up at the corner of his mouth.
Wow.
Just sounds like a really hard guy to work with. But I do agree that the movie doesn't ask much of them as actors. I think Norton is doing most of the work as an actor. I can't see mm-hmm. Ben Affleck in that role.
He clearly is. Yeah, he clearly is.
I mean, and Angela Bassett is probably wasted more than any of them.
As always, I feel like the Angela Bassett role over the year, the average one, is usually they put her in a position of power, but then like she comes in and yells at people and then leaves the scene, and then she's never really a part of the action. And this one, she's not even really that much of an authority. She's kind of a girlfriend. She doesn't want De Niro to do the robbing, and you know, and that's and their relationship is contingent on whether he quits it or not. It's classic movie bullshit, by the way, to have a relationship like theirs, and he is clearly on his last job. She clearly doesn't care about him being on these jobs because they're still kind of casual or whatever.
Right.
But then on his last job, in the middle of it being planned and everything, that's when she comes in and says, "All right, if you stop doing this, we can be together."
Yeah.
And it's like, like, come on, man. I'm always upset that Angela Bassett doesn't get a chance to be in on a lot of this stuff. Like, why don't you make her a partner of some sort? Like, why can't she be, instead of just this, just like, kind of like, I hope you stop doing the stealing. You go, she's the one like keeping an eye on Edward Norton the whole time. And like tells him like, look, this dude, of course we know that De Niro's experienced enough to know that somebody like Norton is going to double cross him by the end. And that's why he does what he does in this movie. And I just thought it was interesting to watch. I thoroughly enjoyed this movie. I'm not here to say, man, this is the first time I've come on here aside from Leprechaun 3 and and Ambulance. And I didn't like this. I just think it's funny how simple this movie is. Like, I'm sitting here going, oh, okay, well, so how's Edward Norton going to end up like double crossing him at the end? And he's probably going to not give him the real scepter. And Edward Norton thinks he's won. And, you know, like, I'm just sitting there like, this is what's going to happen. You know, it's like that predictable. The only thing that wasn't predictable, I thought for sure that head janitor guy was going to get killed. I thought for sure. Yeah. I was sitting there going, it's like, there's a classic setup where Norton's like, all right, time for lunch. And the guy's like, no, let's work through lunch so that we can do this later and everything.
Yeah.
And Norton finds the way, like spills all that, like, I don't know, ammonia or something all over the floor. And then he has to, for some reason, you have to go all the way down to the bottom floor to get all this stuff. And he's sitting there working on it, and he's out of his character throughout this whole thing. And I thought, dude's just going to walk in. Norton's going to not even think about it and blow this dude away. And he doesn't, which is good, I think, but it's not really good for his character. He's the only witness.
Yeah. That's all of this. The thing is that, I was reading up on this to prep, and they actually debated having that character killed. That was mm-hmm. the original plan. And then I guess Frank Oz and somebody else decided that his kindness to Brian had been enough for Norton's character to spare him. But I think it could have made a more dramatic beat if he did kill him. Don't even think about it. Cold blood, boom. And I feel like that's what his character would have done, because he's the hothead coming up to De Niro in the street, bringing a gun mm-hmm. to the park to get the codes. And yeah, that's your only witness. But you know, I do understand why they made that decision.
Yeah. I even like predicted to the line what was going to happen in that when he's going to kill him. He's about just before he killed him. He was going to say, "Why didn't you just go to lunch, man? You could have just gone to lunch, you know?" and then he shot him. But anyway, yeah. What I like about a movie like The Score, and I would say most of your above average, heist movies do this, is they show you all the details of the things that they're going to do in the heist. And there's all this, like, you know, meticulous stuff. Like, we go in and we scout the place with his little camera that he puts up through the little grating and everything. And like, okay, well, there's cameras over here. And there's, like, you know, this is over here. And like, how do we beat that? Oh, it's got this safe here. Oh, this safe is going to be impossible. Well, somebody knows how to break into the safe. So, and the way they break into the safe is great. I think that's a great scene. They fill that thing with water and blow it up.
I love how they telegraph, because he's on the phone and sees the pressurized canisters of, I don't know if it's beer. I think it's beer, on the road. And he just kind of pauses for a second, and then later he shows Norton, "Here's what I'm thinking," and you don't get to see it. And Norton goes, mm-hmm. "Is that even possible?" And he goes, "It's mm-hmm. just physics." And then when you finally see it all come together, and actually Mythbusters did an episode on this exact safe cracking method and deemed it plausible. Mm-hmm. And Frank Oz really wanted everything to be as technical and possible as possible. And that's what I like about it. The Ocean's movies create technologies that don't exist and just go hog. And I love the Ocean's movies. They're fun. But this mm-hmm. kind of a heist, there's another kind of heist is like sleight of hand and whatnot. But this one is more about showing you how a technical, actual robbery like this would go down. Like the thing he has to climb on and him cutting all the little wires. It's mm-hmm. just, it looks like not only a lot of work, but a pain in the ass, if you ask me.
Yeah.
And I love also how Norton fucks with him. Like, he's ready to go and there's no reason to delay. And Norton is just like, I got company. Hang on. And then just sits there and just pipes a little bit and waits.
Right.
And he hears De Niro going,
he's just waiting for De Niro. He's just waiting for him to finally give up. And then he's like, no, you can't. You don't have to give up yet. We got enough time.
Oh, man. I love the Orioles cap, of course. On Norton at the end, who I found out is from Baltimore and is a huge Orioles fan. And to promote this movie, he went and took batting practice with the Orioles and they filmed it. And it made me extremely jealous. And also, the movie The Heist, which I think is the one with, is that the one with Ed Burns?
Oh, just the movie, the David Mamet heist with Gene Hackman?
Yes. I think that was that 2001. Anyway,
it was around that time.
They moved to get away from The Score, moved to November, and ended up making less money than The Score anyway. Mm-hmm. But I don't remember that movie being super similar, just that it was a heist.
It wasn't like heist is your typical David Mamet, where, you know, like The Score has got a double cross in it, right?
Yeah.
That heist is David Mamet, so there are like 50 double crosses in the movie.
Yeah,
like that. It's one of those. By the end of it, like, you're gonna be like, I won't be surprised if this person does another double cross at the end, even though there's no moves left to be made. Like, they find a way to do it, you know. I mean, I guess you don't want to come out with two similarly themed, like, plot wise movies close together like that, and I get it. It always seems like the one that gets released first gets the most money.
Yep.
Although that hasn't always happened. Deep Impact did not beat Armageddon, even though Deep Impact was first. But but anyway, yeah. I remember when this came out, and it's, you know, 2001 was the weird period of time in my life where I wasn't working in movie theaters that much. I had quit Hollywood 27 in February of that year, and throughout all of 2001 was working all sorts of different jobs and stuff. So including being in The Last Castle. So a lot of these movies that came out in 2001, I just completely missed. So the score came out, and I just remember when it came out going, wow, they got Brando, De Niro, and Norton in a movie, and Frank Oz is directing it. How did that go? Apparently not well, but they did a pretty good job given the circumstances. So
I did think there's a specific scene where De Niro and Norton have a conversation about the talent in the choices. And Norton, true to his reputation, wrote that scene. It seems very hard for him to just act in a movie without getting more involved in other areas of the production. But yeah, and Brando improvised a couple lines that weren't in the script that they just went with because he was just being an ass, I guess. Mm-hmm. There's a line in there where he makes a pretend phone call. He's like, oh, operator, we got some nut here who thinks he's gonna get $6 million. Are you okay? Mm-hmm. And that was not in the script. And so De Niro's like, well, what do you mean? Am I okay? And that was a genuine reaction.
Yeah. I'm looking over in the chat, just a couple of comments that came across. Sid says Angela Bassett with a horrible wig. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Castro says Max is the fence, by the way. So I guess that's what they call that kind of character. Yeah, it's one of those. I looked at the IMDb. It's like a 6.9. And I'm like, yeah, that's about right.
Yeah,
that's about right for this movie. I really enjoyed this. It's because it's one of those movies you watch. I just remember totally missing this when it came out, and I still had not seen it until like just yesterday. And going, man, this takes me back to that time in, you know, these movies. Like we would, I think if the score were made today, they'd have to do all sorts of stuff to make sure the audience is sitting there awake and alert and everything. Yep. Like, let's put 40 double crosses in this. And like, yep, you can't trust anybody in this thing, you know, that type of thing.
They'd make the head janitor the ultimate bad guy somehow.
Oh my God. I was like, if this movie were made today, the head janitor is definitely a fucking part of this movie. There's no doubt about it. All right. So are we ready for the secret double feature?
I believe I'm ready for the secret double feature, and cue the comments, suggestions that are already too late. Let's hear it.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
There are a million heist movies, obviously. There are. I even thought about the movie Heist. I thought about the movie Heat because De Niro's in that and has some of the same life questions that he has in this movie. The thing is, and Heat was the leading contender for a while. The movies are not alike, really. Like Heat and The Score are two completely different movies.
They are.
Heat's more of a Heat is both not only the perspective of the robbers, but also the perspective of the cops all the way through. There's no cops in The Score. There's nobody, I mean, except at the very end, and nobody cares about them.
Right.
In Heat, we're going, well, here's Pacino and how his life is and how it affects his personal life. And the same thing goes for De Niro and how it, and like all these millions of characters, like there's like 100 billion actors in Heat. Heat was the front runner, but I was like, man, these movies are just really not the same tonally. There's a number of like older ones, like Rafifi and the Red Circle and the Stanley Kubrick one. The Stanley Kubrick one. What is that one called? I can't believe I can't think of this movie. Someone's gonna name it. Someone's gonna name it on the chat, and I'm gonna feel stupid. There's a Stanley Kubrick heist movie that's really good. And there was all those came through, and I finally said, you know what, tonally, I think the Thomas Crown Affair matches up with the score a lot better. Now, there are two different Thomas Crown Affairs. One's the Steve McQueen, one's a Pierce Brosnan. I'm thinking of the Pierce Brosnan one. John McTiernan directed it back in 1999. Has Rene Russo in it, and it doesn't have a lot of the same things, but it has, I think tonally, you know, it's the same. And Pierce Brosnan, you know, there's a lot of, you know, he's stealing a Monet. I haven't seen this in a long time, but he's stealing a Monet in that movie, I believe. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of things where they're like painting stuff over the real paintings to make it look like the fake, it's like a fake painting, and yep, all sorts of like stuff like that. She's an insurance investigator and she's getting involved with him romantically during the movie. And it's, I think that goes along with the score better than a lot of these other heist movies that I could have come up with. And I believe, yes, Josh says The Killing is the movie from Stanley Kubrick. Yes, I believe that is the movie that I'm thinking of. But I'm going to go with The Thomas Crown Affair. And I know that you love that movie as well.
I love it.
And I think it goes along with the score pretty well.
I think it's an excellent pick because it's a lighter heist movie. But mm-hmm. there's not 50 double crosses. So, you know, it's not as deep and serious as Heat. I think I said last week that I like to pretend De Niro's character in the score is an alternate version of his character from Heat that got mm-hmm. away at the end and got a lot more careful and still heisted. Thomas Crown Affair probably is going to be a big recommend one of these days because it's fantastic. It's sexy. There's a lot of naked. It's the heist stuff is clever without being like, oh, that's cheating. And especially the reverse heist at the end, because he straight up says to the cops, tomorrow at this time I'm going to return this painting. The way he goes about confusing everybody is freaking hilarious. I mean, it's a little out there that he hires like 200 extras, but anyway, The Thomas Crown Affair is an excellent movie and an excellent pick for a double feature. I love it. Now it's your job to give us homework.
Next week's movie is going to be 1999's Go.
Yes,
directed by Doug Liman, his follow-up to Swingers, and just before he does The Bourne Identity. This movie is 1999 as fuck. Has a lot of great actors in it though, and it's trying to play off the Pulp Fiction multiple stories told from different perspectives kind of thing. And I've always found this movie great. I've seen it many, many, many times, but I haven't seen it probably maybe in 10 years.
Yeah.
It's been a while.
I remember the last time I saw it, Melissa McCarthy had just become kind of famous because she's in this movie, way before she got famous. And she's
yeah.
a funny little bit as a roommate.
It's great. I love her little bit in this,
but yeah, I haven't seen this in probably 8 or 10 years. I love this movie. I love all the actors in it. I love how crazy some of the stories get, and there's an all-timer of a music hit in this movie during a car chase, and I can't wait to watch it. For those of you who want to play along, it looks like if you have a premium subscription at Hulu, Amazon Prime, or Sling TV, you can watch this for free. It's on Vudu for $2.99, $3.99 to rent on other major streaming platforms. And highly worth it at that price.
Yes. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of young actors in this that they go on to either bigger things, or I don't know, some of them kind of fade out, but like Sarah Polley has become a big acclaimed director since this movie. Katie Holmes is in this. You have Jay Moore. You have, is it Scott Foley? There's two Foleys Scott Wolf. It's Scott Wolf. Yeah.
Timothy Oliphant is in this.
Yes, is in this. He's Timothy Olyphant is fantastic in this movie.
He nearly steals the whole movie.
I think he nearly does. Tay Diggs is in this. Breckin Meyer, who thinks that he's black in this movie, is in this. Just a million different people, but yeah, I if you haven't seen Go, I can't wait to start talking about this
one. Yeah, me too. All right, let's do some questions before we say goodnight. I mean, happy lunch.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I'm listening.
I think we've talked about this before, but it's worth mentioning again, I guess. What is a bad movie title for a movie you like? And what better title would you use?
Okay. The movie Rush from Ron Howard. The one about, you know, Niki Lauda and James Hunt, stars Chris Hemsworth and Captain Zemo, whatever his name is. That movie is fantastic. I think both of us love this movie, and it's probably, I think, at some point, inevitably going to be a big recommend.
Yeah.
But you know, they asked like what I would call it, and I don't know. I was like Torment of the Gods, or the deadly rivalry of Lauda and Hunt.
Yeah,
or Thor and Zemo go racing, you know, something like that.
Thor and Zemo.
Rush is such a simple title, and you know they probably wanted to call that something different, and then there was somebody in a studio who was like, no, it needs to fit on the marquee, and we've got to make it just one word, and it's got to sound fast, so let's make it Rush or Speed. How about speed? You know, and it's like no. And now that this movie exists, now I have to distinguish between it and the Jennifer Jason Leigh Jason Patrick movie that came out in 1991 or whatever.
Which is also
it was.
Good.
Also good, yes. So you have to go. It's like Crash, right? Crash has got a David Cronenberg version, and then there's the other one that won Best Picture in 2005. Yeah,
you don't want to get those confused ever.
No,
I promise you.
No, you don't. No, you don't. Anyway,
Patrick beat me to it. Only the Brave is my main answer, because it just doesn't communicate anything about that movie whatsoever. And I would have called it Granite Mountain Hot Shots for sure. But I also just now thought of a movie, A Civil Action.
Oh, yeah.
Duvall and John Travolta.
Yeah.
And it's just like your title suggests sitting in court for hours on end. Like,
it does.
That's a very boring title. And it's not a bad movie. I enjoy that film. I don't have a prepared better title except anything but A Civil Action. The Fury of the Gods would have worked for them.
right. Yeah, exactly. Don't drink the water.
Do we have anybody else over here? A piece of fruit in a cup. That's nice. That's a callback. Mm-hmm.
Yep,
oh, yep. Race of Champions, maybe, for Rush.
Yeah. Yeah, I could go with that.
Apparently.
I saw someone on a rant about Up the other day.
Oh.
Apparently in Japan, it's called Grandpa Carl's Flying House. Yeah, I like that better than Up.
I mean, Pixar likes their simplicity, but they could have titled that Grandpa Carl's Flying House, and it would have made just as much money.
And JC says, honestly, I wish either Deep Impact or Armageddon was called Extinction Level Event. Yeah.
Oh, not bad.
I can see that.
Or both of them, and that'd be even more confusing.
Yeah, it would.
Is it the Extinction Level Event with Tay Leone or the Extinction Level Event with Ben Affleck?
Oh, my God. Like, I even have to distinguish between the two.
Well, let's do another question. What things from movies, TV shows are complete fiction to you? I mean, real-world things, not sci-fi things. For example, one-night stands, hitting on complete strangers at a bar, being invited to a wedding with a plus one.
Yeah.
So there you go. What's your answer there?
Okay, so look, I'm gonna say this knowing that this is a real thing, okay, and I don't want to reduce anybody's life and say all that never happens or whatever, but having gone through 12 years of all grades of school and whatever, I was like, I don't know about this open physical bullying I see in every movie. Like, yes, I know it happens, But it seems like every high school and middle school in every movie, doesn't matter what the movie's about, has a set of bullies who will go up and just like physically slam you up against a locker for no reason and then walk away. And I know this happens, but God damn it, man. It's in every single movie. So maybe my problem isn't so much that the trope exists, but that it just seems like they have to put it in everything. And so it's fiction to me because I mean, look, I'm 6'4" and probably people don't want to fuck around with me. I understand that. I remember getting mercilessly like bullied in other ways, you know, like, you know, your appearance or other things like that. But it sure. was always a little bit more subtle than the stuff they do in movies. But I don't remember walking around the halls and like somebody just comes up and like slams somebody up against a locker and walks off. I never saw that. There were fights, but you know,
this is an excellent answer to this question, because in my experience as well, except for 2 years, most all the bullying I ever saw was verbal, was teasing. Then my last 2 years of high school, we moved to a much bigger city that had 3 high schools. First time I ever saw police officers in the hallways. And my first day, I saw that there were 2 friends walking down the hall, and one of them shoved the other, trying to hit me, and I stepped back, and he hit the locker. But even that felt a little more playful, like, hey, there's a new kid, let's just shove somebody into him and act like it was an accident. But there was one incident when I was a junior, and after lunch, you could go into the gym and do a number of different sports, or you could sit out in this kind of causeway, and they had a little snack shop where you could buy candy and soda pops. And I was walking away from that. And this dude, who was probably 6'4", he had, I kid you not, gold teeth, said, "Give me 50 cents. And I did, because I was a little wimp and I didn't want to get my ass kicked. And I fumbled so much that I dropped it. And we were on a slight incline down to the snack bar. And so one of the quarters rolled like 10 feet and he had to go walk and follow it to pick it up. And I felt like that was some sort of justice.
Yeah.
But even that was verbal. I felt physically threatened, but he didn't just come up to me and hit me. So I think that's a fine answer. I've never had a one-night stand. I feel like those happen a lot in movies and TV shows, and people are like, oh, I regret it. I got my one-night stand out of the way. And I never dated anyone where we had a meet-cute moment, like where there's some sort of magical, perfect alignment of events that is just precious and adorable. In fact, most of my meeting of girls I would go on to date was horribly awkward. Cringeworthy, but in the movies, man, that stuff happens all the time.
Over in the comments, Castro says sex in general. Yeah. Josh says having fun in a strip club. That's probably true. Yeah,
I think actually. That's probably true.
Sid says all of the tech in an episode of Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Yes. Castro also says, also, I think a lot of people write dialogue for preteens wrong. Yeah. Because preteens always seem like they're adults, almost, the way they talk in these movies.
Yeah.
Like, just a random example, 500 Days of Summer, like Chloe Grace Moretz in that movie is like a, like talking like a full fledged adult all the way through it. It's weird.
Yeah, it is weird.
Josh says people being out of their jobs or school midday and just hanging out in a cafe. JC says high school parties. I know people who allegedly were at some of those, but I never saw them. See what else is there.
I did go to a high school party once, and it was lame.
Yeah. It's usually not the kind of stuff that you see. Although I heard about a couple of parties when I was going through high school. I was not invited to those parties, but I heard a couple of them where people got kind of crazy. It Don't Connect says high school cliques. I'm the same way. I like sort of hung out with a variety of people when I was going through high school. I had people over here were on the football team, people over here were in plays, and there were a couple of other people who were nerds, and it was just kind of like, yeah, that's the way it goes. And you just had your friend. I don't remember there being a cheerleader clique and you know that type of thing. I don't remember any of it.
I think there was a lot of overlap. Like I was, you know, a nerd because I got good grades, but there was a handful of the people in my circle who were really good at sports in addition to getting good grades. And so I was a lot of co-mingling between the cliques in my experience. But movies, yeah, I think, are just trying to exaggerate everything. Walking into high school, there weren't like, oh, 10 goths over here, 12 hacky sacks over here, Christians praying over here. It's just not how it works. Never once saw this ever.
Now, granted, we didn't grow up in California high school, so for all we know, this was going on in California all the time. But god damn, man, it's so weird watching that, because you're like, what? Like, I never saw that. Well, I think that's gonna do it for today. Once again, thank you guys for coming out chatting and talking up the score and giving some good answers to those questions. Next week's homework is Go from 1999, and I can't wait to talk about it with some of you people who have not seen it. Because, you know, yeah, I mean, 1999, some of you may have been real young when that movie came out. And then when you got to the age where you might want to watch it, you might have felt like you were too old to watch it. I don't know. It's one of those type of things. Anyway, all right. That's going to be that.
Thanks, everybody.
Part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
Entering the studio. I'm here. It's clear. I don't want any more bears. On The Simpsons, with the Bear Patrol episode, they get mad at the bears, and the town storms the mayor's office, and they say, we're here. It's clear. We don't want any more bears. Because it doesn't rhyme.
I don't know that episode.
Oh, man. Yes, you do, I hope you do, because there's that part in the beginning where after they spend millions on Bear Patrol and like a B-2 bomber Bear Patrol flies over, Homer says, the Bear Patrol's working perfectly. And Lisa says, that's specious reasoning, Dad. And he says, thank you, Lisa. And she goes, by that logic, I could say that this rock here keeps tigers away. And Homer goes, how does it work? And she goes, it doesn't, but I don't see any tigers around. And he goes, Lisa, I want to buy your rock. So I had to take my sick cat back to the vet again today. Mm-hmm. This was the plan. Mm-hmm. So he could get more medicines and fluids all day. And yesterday he cried on the way to the vet because he did not know what was happening. Mm-hmm. Today he cried on the way to the vet because he knew exactly what was happening.
Yep.
He was not happy. Mm-hmm. And it's not fun, man. It's not fun. Nope. I mean, they are... By evolution, they make, once they get really upset, they make cries that are very similar to a human baby. Mm-hmm. And it triggers some kind of it triggers something.
Yeah.
In a human being, an emotional response, but also one that you can't really control. I hate it. Anyway, he'll come home tonight.
The three cat Rip has no problem. I mean, he'll meow occasionally when you're in the car, but for the most part, he's like, well, guess we're doing this shit again. So he just kind of like lies there for the most part and occasionally will meow and say, this isn't cool, but he knows there's nothing he can do about it. And then Chester will meow quite a bit, but he's okay with the vet. Domino, who is not scared of anybody, and wants to go up and love everybody and whatever, is the worst about going to the vet. Has to sedate him every time.
Oh, man.
Have to sedate him because he cannot take it.
It's hard as a pet owner because, especially, we don't have kids. So, and you're the same. So, I think our cats are even more part of our family than for most cat owners.
Yeah.
And, but you have to draw a line somewhere where it just doesn't make sense to spend thousands of dollars for what might be, you know, a little more time.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man.
Yeah, exactly.
I hate it. Like, anyway.
Yeah.
What's going on with you?
Oh, nothing much. Speaking of pets, like, here's a thing that had been happening for a while in the last week was that my cats kept dragging a mouse in from outside. And a couple of weeks ago, they drug one in. And it's hard to know what to do when they drag one in, because as soon as you go after them, they run up the stairs and they could drop the mouse anywhere at that point. And this is what happened the first time. They drug the mouse in and I went after them and hopefully they drop it then and there. But no, Domino runs up the stairs with the mouse in his mouth and gets to the top and then drops the mouse. And now the mouse goes into my bedroom where there's a million places to go to hide.
Oh, Jesus.
He goes behind the little TV stand. He goes behind this other stuff. He gets in my closet. I'm like doing all this stuff trying to chase this mouse down with the cat's help, of course, because they've got to do their job. But eventually he gets into my bathroom and he disappears. I was like, where the fuck did this mouse go? Like he was in my sight. He went to where the counters are, the sink is, and then just went disappeared. And I was like, okay, he's behind here somewhere, but where did he go? And I went and got down on my knees and looked under there. I couldn't really find anything where he could have just gone. And then, I'm like, okay, I'm not gonna worry about it, because if this mouse starts running around, the cats will go crazy and they'll start chasing him around anyway. So, like all day goes by and I see the cats every once in a while in my bathroom sitting at this one spot and looking, but I'm like, where could this mouse be in this spot that they're looking? It's just nowhere. It's like sometimes cats have that weird object permanence thing. You take something out of the equation, but they still think it's there. And they kept looking at that thing all day, and I was like, well, the mouse probably is there. I mean, there's no other place he could have gone, so he's probably there. It's about 1 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, no.
The cats start chasing that mouse around. Of course, the mouse is sitting there like making his little wee, 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 wee noises and all that stuff. And I chase him. I chase this mouse around. I'm looking for the best possible way to trap him somewhere where I can grab him and put him outside or something like that, because I'm not going to kill a mouse. And he gets back into that spot, and I finally found out there was a hole that he was jumping up into, like on the very far end of the sink, underneath. And he came out again. I don't know how the cats get the mouse to get out, but apparently they can do something to do it, because I don't know why the mouse runs out in the first place. He runs around, the cats are chasing him around again, and I miss him again. And then I was like, you know what? What am I doing? I need to block off the bathroom. I need to block off so he can't get in the bathroom and go into that little spot. I need to block off all the other doors upstairs so that he can't get into those. And then I need to... you know, I got gloves and all this stuff. And finally, this mouse, he gets out into the hallway, where just outside this hallway, and gets trapped in all the stuff, the blocker stuff that I have, the towels and stuff like that, blocking the opening. Gets caught up in that, and I pick him up, and he's like, wee, 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 you know, whatever. I put him in this little container, and I take him outside and let him run off. And so no more mouse, but that was like 5 o'clock in the morning by the time that was over.
Jeez, that was a terrible dude.
Thing. I know some people, there's no problem. They just kill the mouse and throw it away. And I'm not that person.
I'm not either. We used glue traps at the movie theater I managed.
Yeah.
And I had an employee who was a very entertaining personality, but who was sometimes a handful as an employee.
Mm-hmm.
And they found that while cleaning an auditorium, that one of the glue traps had trapped a mouse, and the mouse was alive. And he picked up the trap to come show it to me, and the mouse bit him.
Oh.
And then I had to send him to the hospital. I had to call in more help. And then I had to fill out an accident report and corporate and do all this insurance bullshit. Mm-hmm. He had to get a tetanus or a rabies shot. And then I had to have a meeting for the whole staff and say, don't pick up the mouse traps. It was really quite frustrating.
Right.
I tweeted this week. Came out of the bedroom and there was a frog in my living room. And thankfully, my two youngest cats were just too confused.
Mm-hmm.
Like they were like, wow, what is that? Mm-hmm. Oh, it jumps. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. And they were following, but they weren't batting at it or trying to get it.
Mm-hmm.
And I put a cup over the mouse and slid a little postcard thing under it. My third cat, who used to be an outside cat for years, is looking at me like, have they never seen a frog before? Mm-hmm. What's the deal?
Yeah.
I take the frog outside and set him on the back patio, and he sits there for like an hour. And I'm guessing he's in a state of shock.
Mm-hmm.
But still, I've spent a lot of time thinking about this. I still don't know how that frog got in my house.
Yeah, they brought in quite a few things. They brought in two birds. They brought in some mice. There was one time, did I tell you about the possum? They brought a possum. They brought a freaking
dead?
Possum in. No, it was not dead.
Oh, shit.
The possum was playing dead, though, when I found it.
Oh, that's frightening.
I was upstairs doing sin stuff. Sin stuff. The possum was just there pretending to be dead. Now, I knew he was pretending to be dead. And I tried to get him onto like a dustpan and tried to get him out before he woke up, but that didn't happen. He woke up and then he ran around and found spots to hide and all this stuff and blah, blah, blah. And finally, I can't remember how I got him, but I ended up putting him in something and got him out. And I was like, God damn it. I was reading something on Reddit the other day that said somebody invented a thing where you have a face ID for your cats to come in the door. So
I've seen something like that. Yeah, you might need to look into that.
I may need to look into that because it doesn't happen like all the time. Look, I've had the cats for 6 years.
Yeah.
And the number of animals they've brought in are still too much, but it's only like 5 or 6. Like, you know, right. So, you know, anyway.
Spring is in the air at Littleton Coin Company, and we want to help you brighten your collection. Visit us at littletoncoin.com all month long to enjoy 15% off your purchase. With a wide selection of coins, paper money, supplies, and more, Littleton Coin Company has something for every collector's taste. Use promo code SPRING at littletoncoin.com for 15% off your purchase all month long. Restrictions apply. Littleton Coin Company, serving collectors since 1945.